Hello, this is Girls Talk About Music, a podcast where women can talk in depth about their love of music and how music has shaped their lives. This is episode 2, Concert Photography. Macmillan is assistance engineer helping the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration keep air travel safe. She works for a nonprofit that develops the control systems that help air traffic controllers keep aircraft separate in the air. In addition to helping keep air travel safe, in her free time, Elvan is a huge music fan who has channeled her love of music into another talent and passion in an unusual way. She has become a concert photographer by taking excellent concert photos from her seat. Attending dozens of concerts a year, Elvan has photographed artists such as Philip Phillips, Young Mayer, OAR, Sting, Melissa Eldridge, and Bruce Springsteen. Through her photographs, she has developed special relationships with fans of those artists who look forward to seeing her concert photos every time, but also with artists such as Mac McAndrew, who she has photographed from the very beginning of his career. I had the chance to talk to Elvan recently and ask her about her love of music and concert photography. Elvan's knowledge and love of both is evident, and I had an incredible time hearing her story. I know that you will love our conversation too. So here it is, our first interview of the podcast, Just Two Girls Talking About Music. Thank you so much for agreeing to participate in this interview today, taking the time to talk to me today, Elvan. So I just want to ask you a bunch of questions about our shared love of music, and especially, you know, how you transform your love of music to a new passion, to a new hobby that you have cultivated for the last several years. For me, that is very an interesting take on fandom.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me. I love talking to you.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So I just wanna go to the very beginning. So where did you grow up?
I was born and raised in Ankara, Turkey. It's the capital of Turkey, but it's not the most exciting town. But I went to all my schooling in Ankara till I graduated from college, and then all my friends up and went to United States to get their graduate degrees. And my dad has been telling me all along to pay attention to my grades. And I was like, I'm never going anywhere. You know, leave me alone. But then once all my friends left, I got the desire. And with a few additional life twists, I ended up here going to graduate school. So I'm still here after all these years.
Wow. So it was after it was so you came. Where do you live currently?
I live in the Washington, D.C. area. And that's because I landed here when I came 32 years ago to go to school and basically never left. Of all the places in the United States, it's a great place to land when you think about it. It's in the middle of the East Coast, beautiful town. It was hard in the beginning because nothing here is cheap, but now I have so many friends here that I consider family, and I have my entire engineering career here, 30 years of working and all the friends I made along the way. So it feels like home away from home.
That is amazing. So you essentially came to do the graduate school and never left.
That's right.
That's incredible. So what was your graduate study? So you did engineering, but in what specialty?
Yeah, I'm an electrical engineer, my undergraduate degree, but I always were interested in computers. And back when I'm that old. There were no computer engineering departments in Turkey.
Yeah.
I had to study electrical engineering, much to my chagrin. And once I survived that, I switched to computer science and did my master's in it. So, but yeah.
What do you do?
So I currently work as a systems engineer, and it's kind of hard to describe what I do. I usually say I do stuff. But I work on air traffic control systems. I have worked on companies and technology firms, not for profit, the one I'm working on for right now, helping the Federal Aviation Administration. And we do all the systems that help the controllers keep the aircraft separated. So it's been an interesting area to dive into. Aviation was not my passion. I was a software engineer when I started, but the more I learned about the subject matter, the more interesting it got. So that became my career. It's kind of funny where life takes you.
Oh, that's fascinating. So what's your place of work?
I have a really nice office in DC. I don't get to see airplanes very often. I don't even get to go to the facilities where the air traffic controllers work very often because they're busy and they don't want us engineers in their face asking questions. But I have been in my career to many a good facilities just because, you know, sort of a study that we were doing or something. And it is most interesting, and they take their job so seriously. Once you see them work, you feel really safe flying in the skies because they know. You know how hard they work to do it right and how important it is to them. So
that is wonderful. And you do fly a lot, but we'll touch on that a bit later. I know you fly a lot to see a lot of shows. So taking it back now to the music. When did you discover your love of music? Did it come from your parents or your family?
Yeah, well, I have to give, you know, 95% of the credit to my mom. And my dad, being the wonderful dad that he was, just doing whatever it took to nurture our passions. But my mother, it was crazy about music. She grew up in Turkey in the 50s, and she was a movie buff and a music buff and an art buff. And she took us to, we had records when nobody else had records. And one of my earliest childhood memories is her letting me drop the needle on a record, I swear to God, because she used to not let me touch the record player for obvious reasons. Those needles are hard to come by, and they're pretty, you know, very dainty little things. So I would say, let me put the record on. She'd be like, no, I got this. I don't think I was tall enough to do it. And I remember her telling me. I might be making this memory up, but it feels like it's one of my earliest childhood memories. And she, we didn't have a whole lot of money, but she would, like when Grease came out, we were all in middle school back then, and we had movie theaters, and every now and then one of these big movies would come through, and we had one or two record shops. And the Grease record, the LP, the vinyl, was in the window, and she could see it in my eyes that I had to have that thing, and she would just buy it for me. And we had a lot of 45s, and she loved all, like, I grew up listening to Nat King Cole, Elvis, Ella Fitzgerald, all the movie musicals. You know, she was just crazy about movies. So Singing in the Rain to, you know, she loved Doris Day. She, like, had lyric notebooks. She taught herself English, but one of the ways she taught herself English was through song and movies. And she also, much to our chagrin, dragged us to listen to the classical music symphony every Friday night, do or die. Like, she would pick me up from ballet class, and she would put a nice outfit on me and hand me a sandwich, and I ate it in the back of the car. And she never let us leave, not even once during intermission, because once we were there, she wasn't going to miss any of it. Like, so I would sit there until 10:30 a Friday night after, like, full week of school, and sleep in the back of the car on the way home. And it was cold. I mean, this is Ankara in the wintertime, you know. But when it came to music, she just was unstoppable. And then she like picked up French during, she was an architect, so she worked full time, but she did take a break and she picked up French. And then all of a sudden, all the French music came into our house. You know, we would listen to Nana Mouskouri and, you know, Jacques Brel and whoever, you know, Joe Dassin, whoever was, you know, singing in French.
Yeah.
It's just, and then my dad's influence was, you know, we have 2-3 branches of very specialized Turkish music. I mean, we had exquisite Turkish pop music, you know, Turkish singer-songwriters. We had all that playing in the house. And then there's Turkish classical music and Turkish folk music. So my dad's inclination was towards the Turkish folk and Turkish art music. So, I mean, I had it all. It was just great. But then, I mean, in middle school, I found the Beatles, and then it was just crazy after that. I mean, that's all I listened to entire middle school. And my mom, of course, I was taking piano lessons.
Yeah.
So money she didn't have. One of the first books I had was the Beatles piano book, and every song was in it. She found it in some one store that sold like foreign books in Ankara. And I would take it to school in my minibus every day. And on the way to school, our school was a little far away, 40 minutes or so. So we would sing Beatles songs from the Beatles book with my girlfriends in the car ad nauseum. And I knew every lyric to every song. And one of the first English books I read was a biography that someone wrote about the Beatles. I read it cover to cover, you know, knew everything about John, Paul, George, and Ringo, and on. I mean, the stories are endless, but that's where it all comes from. It's just my mom had us immersed in it. And she would also take us to see, like, she took me to see a musical when I was 3 years old.
Oh.
And the ushers were like, where are you going with that child? You know, she was like, no, I promise you, she's not going to make a noise and she's going to listen the whole time. And, you know, she was right. And I would just get engrossed in it. And she never stopped taking us to see live music when she can, where she can. So, yeah.
That is extraordinary. That is a wonderful, wonderful story about your mom, because, you know, the topic of this podcast is girls talk about music, and your mom is the ultimate female fan. I mean, she's sounds like,
and let me bring you full circle. I mean, she's like 80 something, and she, you know, slowly lost her eyesight, but we got her an iPad, and she was a very intelligent woman. So she learned how to use that iPad, and the primary thing about the iPad was she learned how to use YouTube. So through YouTube, I was able to share music with her. So when I went to see Eric Hutchinson and recorded him or Philip at the concert, I could put it on YouTube and I could send her the link and she could watch it. And it made her as happy as she was there. And she was 80 something. I mean, this is no joke. I mean, it just truly gave her pleasure to see the music of the artists I like. And she would get it. She didn't say, what are you doing over there? She like you said, I mean, it was her passion too. So, and if it was a good Philip song, she was on it. Like, she didn't have to be explained. Like, this is the new music, Mom. She was just on top of any kind of new music. And on YouTube, all the old music, or she would go, you know, the New Year's Eve concert the Vienna Orchestra does every year, the very special with the waltzes and the dances. Now it's available on YouTube, like the 2nd of January, and she could just watch the whole concert from her lap. And I felt so, like, it just made me happy that she had that at the end of her life, because if she was cut off, it would have been very difficult for her.
Wow.
Technology brings wonders.
That is an incredible story. So throughout her life, she never stopped loving. I mean, nothing turned her from her passion.
Right. And it's her current passion. She wasn't like stuck in the 50s or 80s or like, she just kept going. Like, whatever's the latest, she was on top of everything. She knew the artist, Turkish or otherwise. And I mean, I have an extraordinary Turkish music collection now, because the 30 years I've lived here, both my mom and my brother, sometimes in competition with each other, kept sending me. So I have two of some very important CDs because they would secretly buy it and not tell it. And then it would come out later that I got that for Elvon. And she'd say, no, I got that for Elvon. And I'm like, you know what? You both got that for Elvon. Stop fighting, you know?
Wow. Well, that's incredible. So a whole music loving family. That is incredible. Thank you so much for sharing that with me. I just absolutely love it. You mentioned that it was in middle school when you, so your mom and both your parents introduced you to the music that they loved, but then you found your own music that you loved. So you said it was middle school. It was the Beatles. How old were you?
So I was 9, 10. My brother's 6 years older than me. So think like towards the end of Beatles, maybe. This is 1970 somethings. I mean, maybe Let It Be was just coming out, but, you know, once you get into the craze, so, you know, we didn't have any of this stuff, as you well know. So we had three Turkish radio stations. One of them played from time to time. It was the one that was tilted more towards classical music and Western music. And Sunday nights at 5, there was this one DJ who came on, and that was the Beatles hour. So he would just play Beatles music. And I had a little orange Blaupunkt, you know, tape player recorder thingy that my parents, I'm sure, sacrificed a meal or two or five to buy for me. And you would put it next to the speaker of the radio. So when he started talking and playing Beatles music, I would hit record, and I would record the one hour radio show onto a little cassette tape and then play it for the rest of the week, you know, because that's all we had. And, you know, if I ever heard Please Please Me, because this guy played it once on that radio show on a Sunday at 5 o'clock, and then it was on my tape deck after that, like you couldn't go buy Beatles cassettes. So whatever came through the radio is all I had recorded through this archaic method. Like when we connected two machines together to record sound, that was like 7 years later or something. All you had was the airwaves. And so whatever came through the radio, and if any friends, then you start trading, like, you know, if you had shared passion with people and they had a cassette tape with some other Beatles song, they'd say, hey, did you hear this? Kind of like when we send each other links now, but the cassette was the media. And I did not have a Walkman until we went to high school. A friend of mine's father, who was a friend of my father's, worked in Saudi Arabia. He was an engineer, and they could buy things there that we didn't have in Turkey. So he showed up with a Walkman for his daughter. And I went to boarding school, so that Walkman was in our room. And when I put those headphones on and heard music through my ears for the first time, I thought I died and went to heaven. It was just incredible. And that time I was in, like, Beatles was over. I was into Queen. I mean, I spent my entire high school listening to Queen. Some friends of mine who were into Queen introduced me to Queen, and I just went crazy over Freddie Mercury, and I had every song memorized. And my brother would drop the needle on Fat Bottom Girls and say, they're singing about you. I remember him teasing me.
That's not too nice. What was the first record that you bought with your own money or cassette tape?
So that I could not possibly remember, because that's probably just my mom buying music. Like, you know, I still have. So until she died, she would not let go off those records. And my brother and I just went through the collection. And there was two Beatles albums. One was a red and one was a blue cover. And it had the years on, like 1964 to 1967. So it was like the greatest hits or best of. And she bought those two Beatles records for us. They were printed in Turkey, some of these records. In the 70s. So, and then the record industry totally tanked, and there was this one store when I got to college, and they did this total illegal thing. They had the records, like they would buy it in Germany or something, And for money, they would make cassette tapes for you. So you would go in there, you couldn't buy the records because there's only one. But you could say, the guy would say, hey, got the latest Yes album. And you'd say, here's the cassette. And he would record the Yes album for you and you got to take it home. That's the only way we would get access to music. I mean, it's really crazy how limited we were, other than what's on the radio. And, you know, we only had three state-run radio stations.
It's crazy. That made it, I bet, even much more precious. Yeah, I grew up in Venezuela, but we did have more access. I was able to go and buy some my own records at that point when I was growing up. But yeah, previous to that, I was
music too,
the tapes and so on.
Right. We bought Turkish music too. Like, we had Turkish records. And then here's the best part. So I came to the United States, second day in the United States. I'm trying to find my school. I went to GW. And, you know, GW campus is like in the middle of the city. I grew up, you know, the school I went to was like on the boondocks, had a huge campus, you know, alone, like a, you know, rural college campus. Here, it's in the city. So I'm figuring the registration office and cafeteria, and kids are sending me here, there, and I can't even, there's like no school per se. It's just city blocks with some buildings in it. And I come around the corner, and across from the cafeteria is a Tower Records. And there's like three floors of Tower Records. And I just cried. And I wrote a postcard to every friend I know saying, guess what? Like, we couldn't take a picture and send it back then. We didn't have phones or anything. Guess what? There's a Tower Records on campus. I just lost my mind. Like, it had like three floor classical music section. And like, I didn't have a lot of money, so I couldn't buy it all. But just the fact that it was there and I could like feel it and touch it and look at it was just mind boggling. And then there was the BMG. You sent a cent and they sent you 15 records. Remember that? You could subscribe in the United States to the service for a penny. They would send you 15 records and then you could just had to keep buying them. And I bought my first records here that way.
Yeah.
And I had to go back to Turkey. Like, if I had to spend money to take anything back, if I had to go back permanently, I would have just taken my records and left everything else behind. I didn't have much anything anyway, but like, I wouldn't try and take books or anything. I would have just taken those records I bought and gone back with I came with two suitcases. I would have gone back with two suitcases and then the records, you know. Crazy, all that vinyl we used to buy.
That's right. Do you keep it? Do you still have it?
So moving, I kept a few of those records. I just, you know, either sold them or gave away most of them. And now I'm buying vinyl again because, you know, vinyl is back and I'm still here. So I just keep buying a set of the vinyl. And there's a special record to me, like Foreigner's 4 album, right? It comes out again because it's this 25th anniversary or whatever. That's when I buy the vinyl for those again. I try not to buy too many because, you know, we have access to music everywhere and we can carry it everywhere. But, you know, certain artists, I have to have them all. Like, if Philip puts out a vinyl, I'm not going to pass it up, obviously. Any Philip vinyl, if it comes out in four versions, I'll get all four versions, you know, for a handful of artists that I'm, you know, crazy about. But
yeah, and that's Philip Phillips, for people who doesn't know, that's an artist we both love. that we both love very much, and it's actually the artist that connected us, the artist that we connected through online.
Online,
nice, because people won't know this, but the only connection that we had over the years, and we've known each other online for about 7 or 8 years, is through our love of Philip Phillips. So that's that. So Owen, you know, you carry this love of music your whole entire life. When did it turn When did it become the photography? When did the photography come in into this slot?
So Philip has a lot to do with that. So, you know, we have to talk about Philip and Philip Phillips now because, you know, I mean, I didn't think about concert photography at all, like, period, end of sentence, you know, but I had this tiny little camera and it was the first tour, I guess, well, yeah, it was the second tour, maybe. The Philip started opening for musicians and, you know, I had said when it, you know, became, he just made it, I was like, okay, if he ever goes to Red Rocks, I'm going to Red Rocks. And, you know, our friend Ella Erickson and I made a pact online through Twitter and said, you know, she lives in, you know, on the West Coast and I live on the East Coast. And we said, if he ever plays Red Rocks, see you at Red Rocks. And the minute that the tour got announced with John Mayer and the Red Rocks tickets went on sale, Ella and I, we couldn't look eye to eye because we were online. But man, we just exchanged messages and said, all right, I'm buying tickets. So I had this tiny little camera that nobody argued with getting it into venues. And so I took pictures, pretty dodgy pictures of Philip with that little camera, but it had some ability because it had like a nice zoom or something. And I did some things right. I give most credit to that camera because I didn't know what I was doing back then. And I started sharing those pictures on the Facebook group that we had. And it made people so happy. And then I got some positive feedback from you and others saying, hey, we love your pictures. And that's like, okay. I mean, that's a lot of good things going on. I get to keep my memories. I get to share my memories. People tend to like love it and be grateful for it. And it just gives you happiness. You know, it's just this tremendous source of joy endlessly. So that camera went to some other concerts with me. And then my husband sent me to a photography class. Like, I didn't have an SLR. I didn't have any other cameras. This is like a point and shoot, tiny little. And my brother had bought like this nice Sony SLR. And I was like, you know what? And he was telling me about it. You know what? It's time. Like, I'm going to invest into a, you know, nicer camera. So I bought that same SLR that my brother had. And then my husband sent me to some school to, you know, Smithsonian at these classes where you learn the basics, like how to use it in manual mode kind of stuff. So I don't even remember the first concert I tried to sneak that SLR into, but it has to be Philip, right? It's constant. It is only about taking Philip's pictures. And as you well know, it is hard to take a bad picture of Philip. It's like the most charismatic stage presence. He's just amazing on stage. I mean, there's just not a dull moment, and he knows how to create a moment. I can't put it into words. He's just magical on stage. And when I first saw him on TV and I just got glued to the television, I so bad I left a nose print on it. My husband was like, what's going on? And I said, this guy, I mean, he's just like Bruce Springsteen. Like, I can't take my eyes off of him when he's performing. I mean, yeah, he's singing and all, but it's just him on stage and how what he's doing with the music and what he comes through, you know, when he's performing. So it was all about Philip and trying to take better and better pictures of Philip. Ultimately, my, you know, and then while I'm there, of course, I'm taking pictures of John Mayer, too, because, you know, he's the next artist, like, after Philip. And there I have John Mayer pictures, who's another incredible, like, straight stage performer.
Yeah.
And then people, I put him on Instagram, and next thing I know, John Mayer lovers are after my pictures, and they start saying, I love you, you captured John so well, you know. And it's all about being, you know, capturing the essence of that artist on stage and like freeze it in time or bringing it home. And I love, of course, videos. People take videos of the shows and those are great to capture the, but I just, the snapshot of a moment, you know, just like as if you knew that one picture of Philip that you shared on philphil.com just recently. That is just so quintessential Philip on stage. Like, you know, mid-move, and I just love that picture. And I have many artists I adore, and the more you see them, the more you get to know of those moments that are coming up. Some sneak up on you, some come up, you know they're coming up because you've seen them so many times. Mm-hmm. And that's the joy of photography, is to, you know, next time the same moment's coming up. And when I say something's coming up, like there's a solo or a breakdown in a song, and you know that, you know, Philip's just going to walk up to the organ and they're going to jam together, or he's going to go next to Dave, or there's moments of jams coming up that you've seen that's going to, or Errol Cooney, it's going to happen again. And you, now you're anticipating, and the next time you're like, okay, I did good last time, but here comes again, and I'll capture a different aspect of it. Yeah. So it just makes the music and the show more enjoyable for me. And I know it does. This is another, you know, people say, like, what's that woman doing over there? She's worried about her pictures, and she's missing the show. And they are so wrong. Mm-hmm. They couldn't be more wrong about me missing the show, because I have a camera in my hand.
Yeah. I'm very curious about your process, but before that, I want to clarify, when you talk about John Mayer and Philip Phillips, this is a tour that John Mayer did back in 2013, and it was the Born and Raised tour, and it was a monumental time for Philip fans, because John Mayer was such an established musician, very respected musician, and he called on Philip Phillips, who had just won the American Idol contest, which, you know, in the music circles, credibility-wise, is in the right. Is in the most respected. Then here comes John Mayer, who calls on Philip Phillips to open his shows, which was, I almost fell off my bed when I found out that tour was happening. And yeah, so that's the tour where you're starting to photograph. Right.
I saw an interview with John and Don Was, and it was right before the tour launched, and it was Don Was who saw Philip and put John, you know, told John, you got to take this guy with him. And it didn't take much John to realize what was going on, obviously, but that's the kind of artist. I mean, I know it too, and I am no Don Was, like, and so do you. But if you're in the, if you have the status that Don Was, or, you know, one of those major guys who have connected so many talented artists together, and they take one look at Philip and they go, oh my God, you know, all it takes is John Mayer taking a second look at Philip, and of course he's going to take him with him, you know, why wouldn't he? After seeing just all it takes is one song, one performance to get, you know, an artist at that level.
Yeah, that's right. That's quite magical. Yeah, I was lucky to attend that tour as well at the Gorge, and it was one of the best concert experience of our lives. It was our son's first concert as well. How lucky is that? He was two. I want to know. You were talking about the, you know, when people look at you in the concert and say you're not enjoying the show. I mean, you have found some sort of flow, I think. I've tried to photograph concerts, and it's extremely difficult. First of all, I want people to understand that. Do you get a photograph?
No.
Pass, a press pass?
Never had a photo pass, except for twice in my life. I'm usually shooting from my seat. Mm-hmm. As if it's a seated venue, I'm usually like stuck on that one spot and I can't go anywhere, and I can't blatantly shoot at most of the venues. So some of the venues, not like that, like the Birchmere, they love me and my camera, and it's a tiny little packed place, and I'm stuck in my seat, and the only reason I don't move around is that I would interrupt other people's enjoyment of the show. So I try not to do that even for my table mates, because I don't want to be up there with my camera. So I usually shoot through the gap, or I take it out just for this one song. And most of the people behind me are seeing the pictures I'm taking, and they're not mad because they tap on my shoulder and say, hey, can I have those pictures? And I say, sure, give me your email, I'll send them to you.
Yeah, so you gain some goodwill that way.
But sometimes I will get a request from someone saying, hey, your camera's interfering with my enjoyment of the show, and I'll put it down. Like, I don't never feel entitled to my pictures, especially if I'm just another audience member. And like you said, I don't have a photo pass or anything. And even people with photo passes are very, very respectful, or try to be. Even the photographers, the artists bring with them on tour, they are very respectful of audience enjoyment. So the two times I had a photo pass, one time it was for Matt McAndrew and he was on tour. I was able to, you know, see, he gave me one of his tour passes and just allowed me to move around a little more freely. And the other time was when I adore Adam Pascal and Anthony Rapp. They're Broadway stars and they do concerts together, and I've been their fan for so long. I know their band members, and I was almost at the show, and one of them texted me and said, do you have your cameras with you? And I'm like, yes. And she said, I'm just going to tell the house you're our photographer so you can take pictures. But I would have, if he had given me notice, I would have brought more lenses, you know. I just only had the ones I was trying to basically walk in with without getting called upon. So whatever lenses I had, they told me, like, it was like I was sitting at my seat and some usher showed up and said, are you Elva? And I'm like, yes. He said, where do you want to take pictures from? And I said, I would like to be on the side. And he said, oh, I was going to ask you to please, you know, that's great, because I don't want the other, you know, patrons to be disturbed with the picture taking. So you have to be kind of more discreet and out of the way. And the advantage of being in your seat, this has been my biggest joy, is that, you know, with the press pass, there's this first three songs thing, right?
That's right.
That is not good. That is good, but not good. Because those moments I was telling you about, they're not always in the first three songs. No, if you want to take a great picture of Philip standing in front of his microphone, you know, just singing with his guitar, you're going to have great moments for that. But if he's not singing that one song where he has that one moment in the set list, you're officially not going to have that, not up close. I think you're allowed to roam to the back of the venue, and if you have the right kind of zoom or whatever, you can still try and capture other shots. But, you know, people, I get angry emails from photographers saying, like, I was sitting in the front row at Wolf Trap and Bruce Hornsby was like in front of me, and he did not strap on his accordion until the encore. He was at the piano for the most of the show, and he put his accordion on and he played one or two songs on it. And I didn't even have my big camera. I had my little Sony with me because I just got a ticket at the last minute, and I just found the single seat at the front row. And I have this gorgeous picture of Bruce Hornsby playing the accordion. And I got angry notes from people saying, why? Who let you bring in your nice camera? And I said, it was not my nice camera. And no, I don't have a photo pass, but I captured that moment. And, you know, the guy who had to leave the pit after the third song will never have that picture.
Wow. This is what has caused the greatest curiosity for me. It's like, first of all, and I will put some photos for people to see. I will link everybody to your profiles and Instagram so they can see your great work. The greatest curiosity for me is, how did you achieve such great quality from your seat? Because of course, when you're in the front of the stage, you have no obstructions, you're free to move, you really are doing that job and you're there for that job, so nobody's going to question you. That's one of the biggest fear as a fan, is trying to bring in your camera. I've experienced this many times. My husband has been taken out of venues because he had a camera way back when they were completely forbidden. of course, this has changed enormously because people bring their phones, so they can't do much about it anymore. People will photograph either with their phones or little cameras. So that's my question. How did you achieve such great quality from your seed? I mean, it's as if when we look at your photograph, your photography, it's like you are right there in front. I mean, how have you, I mean, I imagine it has gotten better throughout the years. Have you lost the fear to kind of just go for it? It takes certain courage and certain self-confidence.
Absolutely. I have the thick skin now. I have, when somebody comes up to me and says, put your camera down or why are you taking pictures? I used to get this adrenaline shot through my body. Like now, no adrenaline shot. I just go, you know, I had my camera with me. I didn't know I wasn't supposed to take it. And if they ask me to put it away, I put it away. Sometimes I argue. I say, it doesn't say no photos. It says no video, no audio. It says some places will say no professional cameras. So I'll put away my DSLR and I'll put out my small camera. I won't stop taking pictures unless there's a, you know, real reason. If artists put a note outside, like if you go to see Ryan Adams, there's notes hanging everywhere saying no photos. Like I don't ignore that. I'm not going to try and work around that. I just give up my photos at that show.
That's right.
But if I'm at another concert and the artist loves my pictures and has shared it on their social media and thanked me for it, and some random usher comes to me and says, why are you taking a picture? I have a conversation with them. I say, show me where it says I can't take a picture. And these guys love me. I've taken their pictures before. And, you know, so I did develop tremendous amount of, it's a strike between having the courage and the courtesy. Like you got to find the common ground in between. And if the artist doesn't want it, or if the song is the most quiet song in, I have one of my cameras as a silent mode, so it doesn't even make the shutter noise. But the other camera, if somebody was in a moment in a quiet song, and if I took a picture, everybody would hear the shutter. They would hear the click, and I won't do that. Like, I'm not going to ruin. But in my silent camera, I can take the picture in that quiet moment if that's what I'm desiring to do. Or if it's so quiet and people are so lost in it, that's it. There's no camera involved. I put it away. You know, it's just like I said, finding the opportune moments when it's a big song and everybody's screaming from the top of their lungs and dancing already. And yes, and everybody's arms are up, and yes, I'm going to get hands in front of me when I'm trying to shoot through the gap, but that's part of my photo, and the ushers can't see me, and the noise I make is, like, irrelevant. You know, it's like, it's all over the place. It's just a matter of managing, and I do feel more self-conscious. Like, I had a second row seat at the Avett Brothers show at Wolf Trap. And I had my cameras with me, and those guys don't mind our pictures at all, but I feel more self-conscious having the camera up in my face the whole time when they're pouring their heart and soul in front of me. And I just tend to take less pictures at those shows than some of the others. You know, if the artist is not aware of me taking their pictures, I take more pictures because I feel like I'm not in their bubble, you know, bothering them in any way, shape, or form. I don't know that they're bothered, and if they were. And Mark Roberge of OAR, I love Mark, but he, one time I was at the 930 Club, and I was diddling, I was at on the rail, and I was diddling with my camera. Something went out of whack, and I had, like, total hands down, and I figured it out, and when I looked up, Mark was just singing at me. The whole time I was looking down, he was singing to me, and everybody else, of course, saw that I wasn't looking at him. I was looking at my camera, and the minute I looked up at him, he pointed at me, and he walked away, and I was like, oh, God, I felt so bad. I mean, I felt silly and bad. And thank God I know them and they know me and they know I like taking pictures. So I don't think he was irritated, but he had fun with me at that show.
Yeah, they know you're a true fan of the music, because I think that remains the key thing here, that you had a love of music and you wanted to. I'm always fascinated by the relationship between photography and concert photography.
Guess what? I don't take pictures of much anything else. So there's the connection. Like, I like taking pictures, and I like taking pictures of cats, dogs, animals, trees, whatever. But I will not take the risks or the, you know, troubles I go to for those pictures as I do for the concert pictures. And that is because I adore these artists. I adore the music they make, and I adore the moments they create on the stage. Nothing moves my soul like live music on earth. I mean, it's just that it is for me. I don't have an explanation for it. It is the live theater, and live music moves my soul like nothing else. And the picture I took is a memory of that moment, that feeling. And it's, you know, I have to thank all the artists that allows me to capture that them as you know, as the memory or the proof of that feeling I had. You know, that's the connection. That picture is not them looking good, but the feeling they gave me by playing their music, or, you know, putting themselves out there. When you think about what they do day in, day out, and how much of themselves they put in to what they give us, and those are the artists that we adore. Like, you know that it's their heart and soul pouring onto the stage. They're not just like phoning it in, right? They're there giving you 150%. And it's just, you know, a moment of gratefulness captured in a picture. And when I go back, like, imagine, I'm already forgetting things. I'm 55 years old. And, you know, you forget stuff. You don't remember everything. And that my photo Instagram account of the artists that I've seen, you know, I mean, even if I have Alzheimer's, I know if they show me those pictures, I am going to smile. It's going to be absolute, because they're part of my heart and soul. And my brain might go, but the feeling is going to stay.
That's right. That's the thing with concert photography, because music is such a intangible, right? It goes through time. You can, you know, it starts and
bottle, yes.
You can bottle it, you cannot. So is that combination of capturing that intangible, that right, magic that is just impossible to bottle, and then you kind of capture it in a photo somehow. That's the magic of concert photography for me,
and then going back to the fandom, or being a fan of music in this online thing that we have, like, I have all these friends like you that I never really met in person. It's crazy, but I know that if there's this one picture I took of Philip, say, and I feel in the heart of hearts of me, oh my God, this picture is great, I really captured him. When I put it out there, I know that's what you're going to say, and that's what Erica is going to say. People who know Philip and who've been to a show in another part of the world, in Vancouver or the Gorge or Detroit or Atlanta, wherever they might be, they are going to know that moment that I captured. They're going to say, oh my God, you captured him so well, because they've been there and they've seen it, and that's him. And that's, like, you know, it's priceless. It's just absolutely priceless.
And I will add to that, for the people who don't have the chance.
Exactly.
You know, and I grew up in a country where we didn't have the chance to see lots of live concerts. Those photos are even more precious, because they bring you something to your home, your phone, that you can possibly have. So somehow, you know, it is truly priceless for the fans that haven't had the chance or don't have the chance to see. artists.
Yeah, so much gratitude you get from those people, especially because they say, you know what, I can't go to these. I have so many private messages from people who have told me just that. Like, I can't go, but your pictures make me feel like I were there.
That is wonderful. So, Elvan, I want to ask you, what are some of the favorite shows that you have photographed? Where any special memories, any special shows that is like, that show, I will always remember it.
Okay, let me start with the one, because, you know, going back to not having live music where we grew up and all that, I came to the United States. My husband was my boyfriend at the time, was crazy about Bruce Springsteen. And I only heard, like, I don't know, a handful of Born in the USA songs, whatever they played in Turkey, you know, the hits. And he gave me all of Bruce's music. I just went crazy. And then the first live show I've ever seen in the United States was a Bruce Springsteen show. What a way to start, right?
Yeah. And
we waited in line. This is the time where you had to dial, you know, 703-432 seat to get tickets with your mother's rotary phone. So we waited in line overnight at the venue in line to buy tickets, and we actually got a pair. And so, and you know, I'm always in the nosebleeds when it comes to Bruce tickets, because you know how quickly they sell, you know. It's just crazy that you're just happy you're in the house. I watch so many Bruce shows just touching this, you know, ceiling of the arena, because I'm literally in the backmost seat. So this, the River Tour, twice we managed to be actually get in the pit. You know, I went to Detroit to see it with Erica and her husband, and we weren't very lucky. They have this lottery system to get into the pit, so we ended up in Detroit on the second part of the pit, but there's like this bridge where Bruce kind of walks out and walks in front of you. And then the same tour in Baltimore, I tried. Again, the lottery draw was terrible. The line got cut off like 20 people in front of me. But then the guy who was letting people in said to the 25 people who were cut off, said, "You guys just hang tight and just wait here, because people leave the line and go drinking and don't come back or whatever." And he let 25 extra people into the pit, and I was one of them. And I actually made it into the front of the pit at the Bruce Springsteen show. And I know exactly where he goes to body surf back to the stage. So I made sure I was in his path when he was body surfing. So I have this one picture of him just coming at me head first, that I took with one hand out, just body surfing. And then I had to put my camera away so I can, reach up and touch him when he's coming through. And I didn't know, but when the body surf happens, you're like, you know, your feet leave the ground too if you're little. You know, big guys pick you up because they're just trying to help not drop Bruce. And those two shows were just incredible. I have amazing pictures of Bruce. And then the Detroit show, Bob Seger actually showed up. So at the very end, there's a picture of him and Bruce walking downstage, just hugging each other with smiles on their face. And it's kind of not the best quality picture, but again, it's the moment I captured. And Bruce Springsteen people actually retweeted that picture, which was amazing. You know, it doesn't happen very often.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, have you had any artists that, you know, what artists have shared your photos with their fans?
Oh, so many. I mean, Maroon 5 has shared, because I'm in their fan club, and they treat their fan club fans so well that I'm always in the pit, standing spitting distance from Adam Levine. So I've taken pictures of Adam that they've shared, a couple of Springsteen pictures. And then I have artists like Matt McAndrew, who shares every picture I take pretty much, because, I mean, most of my followers are because of Matt, because Matt has been so good to me. Like, I've been his friend since the first day I met him, I feel like, and he's like been so great about sharing my pictures and giving credit and telling everybody, you know, go follow Elvan, because, you know, she comes to my shows and she takes my pictures. And Yeah, and a lot of my followers are because of him, really, you know, just Matt, and then whoever's come to look at Matt or vice versa. Sometimes I've tagged other artists and, you know, their followers look at my pictures and then they come to find out about Matt because they were following me for my John Mayer photos, but then they listened to Matt and liked them, you know.
That's incredible. So you're connecting the fans through the photography.
Photography, yes, exactly. Yeah. And we actually met one of those people, you know, when we were together, Matt and I. The guy told him, you know, he said, I got to say hi to Alvin because I found out about you because of her. And I love your music and I got to shake your hand. Yeah, so I only have one picture with Bruce Springsteen, and it's funny you mentioned it because this happened back in 1996 when he was touring solo. On a cold winter night, we waited outside the venue because he didn't have a band and like the whole entourage. It was just him and his guitar for like an hour with a handful of fans. Like 20 of us were left towards the end, maybe 25, and Bruce came out. And we yelled at him and he came to the walk to the, you know, rail, and he said people had things for him to sign. And he said, I'm too tired. I can't sign anything, but let me just walk and shake your hands. So he was going down the line shaking hands, and I left my husband in the dust. I don't know what happened to him. And I had like elbow my way to the front and I shook his hand. And there were people with like point and shoot cameras of the 1996 era. This is before digital anything was invented. I see, remember a few flashes going off. And then we had a Bruce Springsteen Digest email list. You would send an email and it would get like clunked into one large email and get blasted out to people who wanted to know. So I wrote to that email list and said, was anybody on this list outside of DAR Constitution Hall taking pictures when we shook hands with Bruce on December 6th? And this one guy emails me and says, yeah, I have a roll of pictures. And he sent me the positives from his roll. And Bruce is shaking hands with the person next to me. But I am in that picture and I have the biggest smile on my face and I'm looking at him adoringly, and that's the only photo I have with Bruce Springsteen.
Wow. That is brilliant. That is just...
It's just universe delivering, right? What are the odds that the guy that took the picture that I'm in is on this email list and is willing to go to the effort of actually mailing me photos? In chance, I'm in it. Like, I couldn't even send him a picture of me saying, here's what I look like, you know?
A long time, and through knowing people like you and Erica, who is another Philip fan and John Mayer fan, and other big fans that are not afraid to show their love, that are not afraid to go to great lengths to see this show, that I've learned a little bit to let go of my fear of judgment. So have you and this I think is very much tied to being a woman.
Yeah.
Who loves music. If I was a guy, I don't think I would have so many questions asked of me. It's just something that guys do, right? They love music and they're fans.
Yeah. We are referred to as groupies, right?
Exactly. So throughout. So yeah, exactly. So have you experienced any judgment about your passion for music and concert? Because I know you attend, and I didn't ask you. I know you attend a great number of concerts throughout the year. Have you had any judgment, people asking you, are you going to see the artist again, repeat shows and so on, being so passionate about it?
Yeah, so I'll tell a few things about it. Yes, people judge you. And 99% of the time, it does not matter to me because life. I am old enough to know that I don't care. Honest to God, from the bottom of my heart, I do not care. I don't want to say I almost want to say what anybody thinks about me and my passions. I have, you know, my days on this earth are numbered, and I may have wasted a good bunch of them already. So let's not have any regrets, but let's live it to the fullest extent. Do more of what you love. Like, write that down, put it on your fridge, right? Time is limited, and you find this out like when some dramatic life event happens to you, dramatic or traumatic. Some people experience it very early in life. Other people, sometimes later, maybe some people never experience it, and that's good for them. And I hope they may have already come equipped knowing, you know, how to live life to the fullest. You don't have to learn it the hard way, but that's my life experience. So I'm just sharing it. Only time that really, really hurt my feelings was I had a friend that I was really close with at work. And I walked into his office, and there was somebody there that I know through work that doesn't know me so well. And in the context of that conversation, I was referred to as a groupie. You know, Alvin's a groupie here. So it really hurt my feelings, and it kind of made me cry a little bit. And I tried to let it go. You know, I counted to 1,000. I walked around the block for about a week or so. And it just didn't, the hurt didn't go away. And I love this friend too much to not say anything. I would have to just let him go out of my life. I mean, it hurt so much if I didn't say anything to him. So I sat down and wrote an email to him, explaining to him what he said hurt me so much, and why I do what I do, and what it means to me to do what I do. And that word has a connotation, and I don't associate with that connotation, and I don't want anybody else to associate it. That, especially because he said it at work in front of somebody that doesn't know me. So I wrote it to him, and like the minute it hit his email, like he was calling me and he texted me and he said, I'm so, so sorry I made you feel that way. And thanks for telling me, and I appreciate you telling me. So my advice is, if it's somebody you don't care about so much, acquaintances, not that we don't care about them, but what do they know about you anyway? You just let all that go. If it's somebody who knows you, who matters to you, and they say something about your life or your way of living or your way of music loving that somehow hurts you in any angle and might come at you, then put the time into having the conversation with them and explain to them why it hurt you. Not why you do what you do, because they're never going to get it. It's you. Like, you're the only one who's going to get that. And there are people who are like kindred spirits like me who will get it. Thank God there's like thousands of us who don't, you know, we're not like a minority or anything. There's plenty of us around. And so stick with those people when it comes to the artist and anybody else. My only hope is that maybe they will discover that artist like we spoke. Pardon my language, stereotypes out there for women that you categorize under. And like, calling somebody cougar is such an offensive thing to tell someone that you don't know. Okay. Absolutely. It is so offensive and so disrespectful to tell to a woman that they're like a cougar or a groupie. Like, if you're in your 20s, you're a groupie. If you're in your 40s, you're a cougar. And I don't know, if you're probably, when I'm in my 60s, they're going to call me crazy. You know, what's this old lady in the front doing dancing, right?
Yeah.
Stereotypes are endless, and people will just try and fit you into one of them. And like, women have more. And, you know, I don't want to single out women either. I'm sure men get thrown into, like, if a man loves a male artist and follows them, like, a woman, I'm sure they get put into a whole different kind of stereotype. I'm sure there's especially if they stay sober through the show and they don't drink themselves silly. Like, there's so many stereotypes. But none of us are any of them. I mean, I don't know where stereotypes come from, but you can't put a label on me. And if you do, shame on you. And it might limit my friendship with you, and probably no loss on either count. Like, you know, most of these people are, you know, acquaintances or online people, or will call you that because they can when they're online, and they will never be able to say such a thing to your face.
That's right. Evan, that's so wise. I love it so much. You know, I've learned to shed all my fears, not all, but a lot of my fears, through seeing people like you do what they love so fiercely, really, and do excellent work. I mean, to elevate something you love to something that other people can enjoy. It is wonderful. You are doing something so great. And the quality of your pictures, the beauty of your pictures, it really will transcend. You know, it's a great gift for fans. So I thank you so much for that.
Let me thank you. Take the opportunity to thank you, because you did the opposite for me. I have all these thoughts and feelings that are stuck in my brain, and I don't have the talent to write. And you do that for me. Like, when you write about Philip and I read what you are, or anything else, you write with such passion and such like authenticity that when you write and I read, I'm like, oh my God, thank God somebody said it and said it so well, because I wish I could, but I can't.
But so, you have the camera. That's not an easy art, to be honest with you. I think concert photography is one of the hardest to master, and you have mastered it, and I know you will continue. I mean, really, it's not an easy art.
Wait till I retire. I'm really going to follow people around in my car, concert to concert. So, yeah.
And I can't wait for that. I will so enjoy it. So, Evan, I enjoy so much our conversation. Yeah. Thank you so much for taking the time today to talk to me.
Thanks for the opportunity to let me, you know, tell all my crazy tales.
It's wonderful. This is all I hoped for and dreamed of. And thank you so much. I just want to mention, before I let you go, where can people find your photos?
The best place to go is Instagram. I have a photography account called @ElvonMCM. It's my first name and the first three letters of my last name. And that should get you to my feed of my concert photos. If you go, you can't go too far back on Instagram, thank God. If you go far back, you'll find cat, dog, and human pictures too. But at one point, I started a personal account to separate out the concert pictures. So the last 3-4 years worth of work. And because I'm an amateur, I'm not too picky about what pictures I put on. I put the ones I love. Some of them are not the best quality, but I love the moment, and I don't try and restrict the number of pictures to 2 or 5, or if they're good and I love them. Some shows have less pictures and some shows have more. So yeah, hopefully people will enjoy them. That's all I ask. That
I think they will. And I should have asked you this before. Do you have any hopes of, well, you just mentioned when you retire, you're going to follow concerts around, which is my dream as well. Would you consider turning into a professional photographer? Would you consider going for it?
Well, I could try. Under my current circumstances, it just didn't make sense financially to try and become a professional. But as a supplemental income for a retired old lady, yes, sure. I do feel bad when people, but I will have to find a way to like put my pictures out there and let people buy them if they want to. It is very hard for me to say no to some artists who, I mean, I've had emails from artists asking me if I sell my pictures, and I just send it to them. So I will see if anything, opportunity presents itself in any one way, shape, or form. Plus, Matt promised me to take me on as a tour photographer when he's a big rock star, and I'm an old lady, so.
It will happen, and I can't.
About these things, but, you know, that's one way to have really good fun with an artist you love, is that if you do become, and you know, I asked John Mayer for a job, right? I never told you this. At the meet and greet. He has a photographic memory, and it was the second meet and greet on the same tour, and the minute he saw me, he said, I met you before. And I said, yes, John, we met in Philly, and I took your picture, and I had brought him a canvas to give, but the security guy had taken it from me. So I told him, I took a great picture of you, and I brought it to you as a present, but he took it away and put it on that table. But then I said, if you need a washed-up Turkish engineer for your tour photography, I'm available. Just give me the word. And he laughed and laughed and said, I'm going to remember that. And I said, you better. So I'm still waiting
for him. You never know. That is bold, and that's how I like to hear it. That's exactly what I love. That is just what more of us should do, especially women. We have to be bold and go for what we love and what we want. I love that story, Elvin. Again, I thank you so much. This has been a huge dream and a pleasure for me.
Thank you. I love you, and thanks for having me. And I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation, and I can't wait till we meet for real someday.
And we will very soon, I hope. Thank you so much, Elvin.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Our conversation. Thank you very much for listening, and a huge thanks to Elva McMillan for taking the time to talk to me and be the first girl to talk about music in the podcast. If you would like to see Elva's beautiful concert photos, you can follow her on Instagram at ElvanMCM. That's ElvanMCM. And that is all for this episode. More conversations coming soon. In the meantime, keep listening and being a fan.
Girls Talk About Music is written and produced by me, Andreina Romero. The image design is by Pamela Rolim. The music theme is by The Good Sister. And the drum samples are by Sebastian Lavigne. You can find this podcast on Instagram at Girls Talk About Music.